You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Second City is back open for live shows, classes, and customized corporate workshops and events. But we also have all those things available in virtual formats. For more information, go to secondcity.com. You're listening to this podcast. You love podcasts. Hopefully, you also love the Second City and our work. You know who else will love podcasts from the Second City? Your colleagues and employees. I'm excited to share a new partnership that the Second City Works is entering into with Venly, an audio technology company that allows businesses to share audio and podcasts directly for employee engagement and learning and development. Our new series, First Takes, uses amazing corporate insights and teaching that we've developed through the years and communicates it in 8 short podcast episodes. Share this content with your employees on channels like Slack, Microsoft Teams, SharePoint, FirstUp, and your LMS, all with enterprise-grade security, privacy, and analytics. Interested in sharing this content and learning more? Register at www.venly.co/secondcity, and we'll get you set up. Once again, it's www.venly.co/secondcity to get access to the First Takes content series. We're looking forward to learning with you and your colleagues. So today's guest is my friend, Dr. Adrian Boise, who is a practicing neurologist and global thought leader, who was most recently chief experience officer at the Cleveland Clinic. And now she is the first chief medical officer for Qualtrics, which is a tech firm in Silicon Valley. She's a pal and she's super smart. And I think you're going to enjoy the pod. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Dr. Adrian Boise, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's so good to see you.
It's really good to see you. I was reading an article that you wrote called Empathy is Everywhere and Nowhere at the Same Time. And one of the quotes from that article is, quote, perhaps we are all survivors of brokenness, end quote. While some people might think that you're making a really sad statement, and I would say, well, an element of that, of course, is the case, I don't see that quote as being purely sad.
Right. Well, it starts simply in a place of recognizing that suffering is a big part of all of our lives, yeah, in one form or another. I think the hope and the journey I would want people to see in it is the notion that we all move through that. There's a process, whether it's a beautiful process or it's an ugly process or a painful process or a slow process, we all keep putting one foot in front of the other to get through it. And often on the other side of that, we're not the same people. We're somebody different. We emerge differently on the other side of that. And that's okay. That can be a good and a beautiful thing.
But it's hard, right? And this was the conversation we were just having before I hit record, which is, you know, there's a war in Russia's invaded Ukraine. It's terrible. You got on the call and go, how are you doing? And I've had a really good week, you know, and not, again, not that I don't wake with that news and that news doesn't bother me, and it does. And I've had those conversations with other people, but I've also been, I don't know, very satisfied with my work this week. And I had great therapy session last Thursday and I've got one tonight. So, you know, and I'm going to go out to a restaurant tonight and have a meal. And I mean, so I guess this idea of this duality, which is hard for human beings, right? It's that idea of holding two opposing thoughts in your idea at the same time, which Fitzgerald said was intelligence. But that's something I think in your field, in the healthcare field, you definitely, like, you experienced that on steroids.
Well, wow, you threw me a lot there, Kelly, as usual. I would start by maybe reflecting on, you know, from our mutual friends, Adam Grant and Sheryl Sandberg, right? This mm-hmm. idea of how are you today, right? Yeah. That grief, trauma, duality, whatever it is that you're holding, it's about how are you holding it today? Not that you're expected to hold it all beautifully every day, but to make that question more relevant and present for each other is mm-hmm. simply to ask in this moment, how are you? I also, amidst all of the trauma that you're describing in the Ukraine, I also have been so inspired by some of the beautiful things that people are doing.
Yeah.
At Qualtrics, you know, they're matching internal donations for Ukraine. I mean, what a beautiful gesture of a company to say, right. We want every single person to contribute in any way that they can, and we're going to match that. The inspiration that has come from the Ukrainian leadership, right, in the messaging.
The comedian.
I mean, well, right, maybe you influence that. But the messaging and the clarity and the hope that he's offering so many people, it's very touching. And the generosity across the border today. We just had a session with one of our colleagues in Poland, and he was describing how they're doing everything they can to show up at the border and manage donations. So there is beauty in some of our darkest moments. It doesn't detract. It doesn't lessen the dark, but it can be held at the same time.
So we met when you were the chief experience officer at the Cleveland Clinic, but now you're the first chief medical officer for Qualtrics. What is that? What do you do? What do you do as the chief medical? They've never had one. And you're probably gonna have to explain what Qualtrics is to people. I think Kim Scott might've on a past podcast, but I'll let you talk about that now.
Well, Kelly, as always, you and I are blazing trails, right? We're just following our big hearts into the unknown. Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right. You know, part of the fire in my belly is to reduce suffering and create joy in the world and in healthcare, certainly. As a neurologist, I try to do that with my patients and have been doing that for 20 years. In my most recent role as chief experience officer, trying to drive that operationalizing empathy at that system level. How can we integrate it into processes and systems that make the organization and feel caring to the employees within it, as well as the patients? And then I felt the need, after doing that for 6 or 7 years, decided that I really wanted to see if we could leverage technology to listen more deeply, to understand not simply what people say, but what they value, and to act on it, which you and I both know as the foundations of actual compassion, right? We're not listening to create dashboards. We're not listening to tell people they have to achieve a percentile performance, right? We're listening to deeply understand who the people we work with are and who the people that we serve are. And then hopefully changing the next touch, the next conversation, the next moment, so that it could be a moment that matters. And I came to Qualtrics in part because they're some of the smartest people I know. Right there. I mean, it's a technology company. They are driving what they call experience management, which is a foundational platform that's integrated with all sorts of technology and capability around brand building, around listening to employees, around listening to patients or customers across all industries. So finance, tech, telco, government, education, healthcare is a big bet for them. So they're making a lot of investment there. and not only sort of super, super smart, and I thought I could learn a ton, but huge, huge hearts, right? How can we shape this amazing technology, these digital tools that we have to bring more heart into healthcare? How could we use it to actually deliver on the promise of person-centered care, where we're integrating values and preferences of people into how we communicate with them, how we design programs for them? So that is fascinating to me. And I thought I'd give it a try. So here I am. And it's been an absolutely wild ride. I'll tell you, they move much faster than we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's been a little dizzying for me, is one of the biggest observations. On my first day, I had a colleague whose baby has cancer. I know that's near and dear to you. Mm. And on the very first day, someone had counseled me, you know, we're a technology company, you know, that empathy and healthcare stuff might be hard for you to make the transition. And on the very first day, there's like 200 people on a meeting. Everybody writes the name of this baby on their hand, and everybody's got their cameras on. This is a place where everybody puts their camera on, Kelly. You would be so excited.
Yeah.
And they all hold up to the camera, their hand with the name written on it. And I nearly exploded with joy. That what a way to bring your heart to the work. What a way to show up for each other. So simple, and yet so compellingly, heartbreakingly stunning on my first day.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I know we talked about this duality before, and I'm seeing another duality. It's just popping in my head right now, which is the knowledge that the tech space is going to need to collaborate with the things that are most human, storytelling, problem solving, all that jazz, resilience. And then when I think about you, and I'm like, oh yeah, you studied as a ballerina, and you do neuroscience. So you also blend what people might conceive of as the soft and the hard, though I think they're both pretty hard.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, I don't know if that's the way you think of yourself and your pattern, but I'm like, oh no, that's a thing, I think.
Yeah. Well, anybody who tells you empathy is easy has done it very well. So we're aligned in that one. I mean, I think I wrote something once that said, you know, empathy is easy when you resonate with the person you're trying to empathize with, right? When there's some implicit bias or something that feels similar and looks similar, it's hardest when we can't get that footing with someone and we're still trying to step into that space of empathic curiosity. You're absolutely right. I mean, my husband always jokes, he's a neurosurgeon, I'm a neurologist, and he always jokes that I should have been a neurosurgeon because at times I'm very, very left brain, right? Like, let's get this stuff done. We got places to go. Da, 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 da. And other times, right, I'm sobbing at Disney movies that I've seen 9 times. And so I think it is I am a blend of left and right brain, that artistic love of ballet and movement and how the arts could come into healthcare and help us heal is something I've always been passionate about, interested in. The written word, right? How we could leverage that to appreciate more, have more of an impact, and yet also a deep appreciation for, you know, we need to set OKRs and KPIs, and we need to develop plans to drive toward them. And, you know,
right.
I think I try to balance those parts as best I can, and have learned to just embrace the joy of imbalance, right? It's all a big mess in reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're just a potpourri of both.
Yes.
And I do think we as an industry could learn a lot more if we pulled in, you know, imagine the therapeutic benefit of having caregivers in healthcare or employees, you know, do their own photography and put pictures on the walls that were appropriate, right, of course, but you know, as a way of their own healing, to use the arts to express where they are and how they're feeling, and to have an organization support that. I think those are the nooks and crannies I'd love to see come to life.
Well, and I think, you know, at the Cleveland Clinic, they've done some amazing things around art and music, and even improvisation. I mean, that was the thing that when I think we first met at a conference, I started talking to colleagues of yours about using improv, and they kind of were smiling at me. I'm like, what is it? And literally they had my book. She's like, oh, I teach your exercises. They're not my exercises. They teach exercises developed at Second City over the years.
And yeah, like, they were probably all dog-eared and like markers.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a wreck. I loved it. It's the best feeling in the world that someone's like gone through it that much. Oh, by the way, I do want to take this opportunity. Like, I really hope at some point in your life, someone has said to you, what do you think you are, a brain surgeon or a brain scientist? Like, why yes would be the answer.
Well, I used to, you know, I used to be a bartender, speaking of bias. And I was a bartender in Boston for about 10 years. And I was teaching ballet.
That's a chunk of time.
That's right. And I was teaching ballet before I went to bartend. And then I was doing neurobiological research during the day. And so the funniest thing that would happen to me, people would come up to me when I was bartending and they'd be like, hey, how's it going? You know, I'd like a Cape Codder. I'd be like, okay, make their Cape Codder. And they'd be like, so what do you do? You know, is this what you do? And I'd be like, no, you know, I do neurobiological research at, you know, Brigham and Women's or at Boston University, depending on where I was. And they were like, no, you don't, you know, no, come on. They'd start laughing. And I'd be like, no, really, I do. And then they would just keep laughing. So then I decided I would just say, you know what? You're absolutely right. I have been studying how to make a Cape Codder since I got here.
Right.
This is very complex work, and I want to make sure you have the right garnish. Thank you.
This reminds me of a time I was in Houston because someone wanted to build a Second City down there. And I was going to all the different sort of like biggest entertainment stuff, and strip clubs are huge down there. That is a thing. And so I was like, you want me to go? Like, I just got to get this pre-approved on the credit card before I go.
Where's this going, Kelly?
It's over quickly. It's not. But one of the strippers is like, what are you doing? I go, I'm doing research. I'm like, this is the lamest thing in the world I'm going to say. But I have a notebook. It was like, I have the notebook and I was writing stuff down.
Yeah, I'm sure that counted as huge credibility for her.
Yeah, yeah. I did. That stripper actually did the next day take me around to other spots. I got approval from my wife, Ann, first to like look at cool spots where a Second City could go.
Good to know. Only you would get away with that story.
It's one life. It's eclectic. One must live it. Speaking of which, so you wrote a really great blog piece recently that starts with this quote: since the emergence of COVID-19, the National Academy of Medicine reports that about 20% of healthcare workers left the industry. And of those who remain, 4 out of 5 say that staff shortages have negatively impacted their ability to work safely and care for patients properly, end quote. I just did a keynote for Lurie Children's Hospital, and this was a major thing on the list. It was, can you talk to us about burnout and resilience and all of that? Because that struggle is just so, I think it was always a concern, right? And just now it's amped up beyond measure.
Well, the sheer cost of it, right? I mean, the people cost, the emotional cost, the operational cost of, right? We all hear these phrases that get thrown out, right? It costs less to keep the customer you already have than to get a new one. It's the same with employees, right? The cost of them leaving is substantial. And then the contracting cost, where you're seeing people contract out agencies or part-time workers to fill in, are also substantial and compound, I think, that loss. I think for you and I and others who care so much about the experience of humans, the emotional cost worries me a lot too, that if we function as highly performing teams to deliver complex healthcare in some hospitals and in some situations, what does it mean when you no longer know the people who you're working next to because they just came in for their shift that day? What does it mean in terms of how you're able to show up and what level of empathy that you can bring to the workspace when you're worried about X, Y, and Z going on in your own life. What's your commitment level, right? Most healthcare workers are deeply committed to the work we do. And when you see the person next to you making three times as much money as you do, you know, with a shift work schedule, you know, it makes people wonder. And so I worry about what that means for how people are able to show up and be right. Their best selves. That's the part I worry the most about, because empathy does require hard work.
Yeah.
And when your own bucket is empty, how can we creatively fill it? How can we create more energy for people to show up the way they want to?
Well, one of the things you talk about is bravery, but not bravery in like a war movie sense. You say, quote, being brave is about being who you are. So I want to unpack that a bit, because, you know, we're multifaceted weirdos, and all of us, we're so connected with each other, right? But we're also thoroughly unique, yeah. More duality. So to talk to us a bit about, like, even with you, like, how you are who you are and how you show up successfully at work with that.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you some examples. Maybe storytelling is the best way to answer. Mm-hmm. When I was in medical school, I remember there was an anatomy class where the situation was such that there was a hearing impaired student in the class. And yet the policy was we didn't record any of the teaching sessions. And there was one session where the hearing aid or something wasn't working for the student and the policy wasn't going to be changed. You know, they were just going to miss out on that learning. And I remember being like, well, that's dumb. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking up and writing the professor and saying, you know, that makes no sense, right? We need to be inclusive in how we teach anatomy in med school. Like, we're healers. He's a member of our team.
Yeah.
So speaking up, and it felt really awkward and weird.
Sure.
I remember another conversation in medical school when the teacher it was one of these humanities classes, which aren't very well embraced all the time in med school, because you're trying to get people to relate to these profoundly deep experiences that many of them have never had yet. No. Right? You've never told somebody they have cancer. You haven't had a patient die. And yet here we are trying to teach them how to imagine through it. And the question was, well, what are uncomfortable topics for doctors to be talking about? And of course, there's like 5 minutes of silence. And I said, well, sex, like, that's probably hard for doctors to bring up. And it's hard for people to talk about and uncomfortable. And the teacher looked at me and said, I'd like you to stay after class. And when I stayed after class, she told me that I was being irreverent.
What?
And I thought, you asked a question about what makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I answered the question, and clearly it made you uncomfortable, because now I'm after class, you know, getting detention in medical school. And I don't bring it up for the shock value. I just bring it up to say, and that held true, I think, as I moved through, that even empathy, these things I cared about, staying late in the rooms to see if patients really understood what we had said, or going back to talk to the family when they still had questions. I think many residents, many fellows, all have the experience of spending that time that doesn't necessarily count, right? In terms of getting things done. We didn't get the echo report. We didn't do the discharge summary. These tactical things that need to get done, these are purpose-driven things. And yet you spend the time because it's who I am. And it's not always reinforced during training. And I just want to reflect that at some point I sat with myself, like, you know what? I seem to be interested in all these things that not a lot of other people are interested in.
Yeah.
And clearly I can't shake it, right? I can't keep my mouth quiet, although I will always work to do it in a respectful way, you know, being careful about how I use emotion and storytelling. And I am someone who will speak up, and I am someone who brings my heart to the work and is curious about the hearts and minds around me. And that's just who I am.
Yeah.
And I'm going to stop apologizing for it.
Right.
I'm going to stop expecting other people to be like me. I'm going to step into who I am and live both my work and my life in accordance with what I understand about my values and my joy pie. And that's very freeing, actually, once you do that. It's not easy, because I did feel weird at multiple points in my life. I still feel weird and awkward. And it's how I choose to show up.
Well, I would imagine that you have many rich relationships in your life.
I hope so. I'm an introvert by nature, so I would much prefer depth to my relationships and the people who are closest to me, my friendships, more than I'm very good at surface or, you know, because if I'm going to expend energy, I want to spend it in meaningful ways.
Yeah.
I think we all say that in some ways, but our meaning might look different, right?
Yeah. I say this too, because certainly in my early career at Second City, as I'm watching really successful comedic writer performers, they are so adept at creating stories and characters that draw from their lives, and they become incredible storytellers. And then I sort of realized, oh, when I'm looking around me in the office, the people who are most successful are people who are doing the same thing, who are not afraid to tell their fiasco, because frankly, no one wants to hear how everything went great. That's not funny or interesting. I want to hear when it goes awry. But also, like, in even the smallest of details, and we know this from our work with the behavioral science community, that kind of like personal storytelling, which I think will breeds resilience. I think when you are comfortable sharing that story, there's something that goes on, especially when you see how mostly it's very well received, deepens the kind of communication and the ability for people to tell the truth. Not that they're looking to lie. It's that kind of self-disclosure is not easy for human beings.
No. In fact, I feel incredibly vulnerable after I share pieces of myself. Mm-hmm. You know, at the conference we've had you at in the past, it's hard for me.
Yeah.
And yet, I read something once from Brené Brown that you have to be careful about why you're sharing your story, right? Mm. I'm not sharing my story because I need empathy from people, you know, or because I need to show that my suffering was greater or less than anybody else. You know, I think it's a really important question. I hope that we all share stories for the benefit of someone who might be listening, watching, learning themselves, to recognize everybody is messy. You know, I don't have it all together, and I'm working very hard just like everybody else. And I've got brokenness too. And it's a daily struggle, is not the right word, but a daily intention.
It's a daily intention. Yeah. And in that idea of moment to moment, even. And that's a more difficult way to exist, but I think ultimately, if you can find a way to practice, find what your rights are, where you rest, you need rest. You can't keep at this all the time. All that stuff, I think, is just you're going to be a happier human being, and then you're going to be capable of making other people happier. I know it's a bit reductive,
isn't the thought? I heard this once about improv, and I'm sure you can correct me because you're the godfather of improv. But the idea too of improv was this notion, which I've always either just made up in my head and ran with, or is actually true. But part of the idea is the word comes from the idea of improving, right? You're here to improve the moment you're in, improve the conversation. And we use improv, makes me think about how could we improve the lives of someone else? How can we improve the conversation? How can, so again, whether I made that up or not, please don't.
You made it up, but it's good.
Make it up. Well, perfect.
Yeah, but it's good. And in fact, the thing that it does connect to is this idea of my job as in an improvisation is to make you look good. And your job is to make me look good. And when we can become truly others focused, we all win. All of us are better than one of us. So mm-hmm. I think those adages are so affirming because the work really is about like, how do we get the best out of groups of people working together, making something out of nothing? And as you know, we've both worked in a variety of teams that have been dysfunctional or, you know, problematic or whatever. But then when you work in a team where it works, that's what's happening.
Well, it reminds me of the, you know, empathy has gone through so many renditions over the years with different psychologists looking at it, right? Like that we went from recognizing that if you are aggressive to a Bobo doll, if the parent is aggressive to a Bobo doll and kids watch it on video, the kids, when left alone with a Bobo doll, are going to go in and whack it with a bat or, you know, punch it. So there's a modeling component to it. And then later evolved to this notion that empathy was the idea to feel into that not only modeling has an element, but empathy was this idea to feel into art, feel into the experience of another while still maintaining self, right?
Yeah.
And so as you're describing with improv, it reminds me of that you're still hanging on to your own position and place in the universe, and you're trying to improve the experience or trying to lift another as you practice your skill. And to me, there is something therapeutic and beneficial to the ability to step outside of self.
Yeah, for sure. The thing you talked about quite a bit too is gratitude. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a bunch of research on this, and I was reading, I think it was Stephen Covey's new book. I'm going to have him on the podcast soon. And he told this story about the former PepsiCo CEO, Indra Nooyi. And she was trying to change the culture at Pepsi. And she landed on a thing that she did. And in her time in that position, she wrote over 400 letters to the parents of her employees saying what a good job they were doing.
Oh, right? You just hit me in the heart.
It's beautiful. What a beautiful move. I'm like, because everyone wins. Because you know that parent called their kid and were like, your boss just sent me a letter saying how, like, if a boss sent that to my son, I would be like over the moon. And you know, the son or daughter are over the moon.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? I have a thread of letter writing in my own story.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I lost three fathers to the same disease, and one of them was abusive in my home, and that created me gravitating toward a lot of other families as I was growing up. And when I look back, there were people who I wrote to once I became a neurologist about how they had impacted me on my journey. One of them, I wrote very personal essays about my experience growing up as part of that narrative piece of your med school application. And only one person asked me about it on my interview trail. Hmm. And I reached out to her years later and said, I want to tell you the story of how it felt to have one person, you, read my essay and then be brave enough to have a conversation with me about what had happened to me and how it shaped me. And she wrote back this beautiful note saying, you know, absolutely made the right pick. You know, you're exactly what healthcare, you know, just these beautiful sentiments. And I not only felt almost closure, but this incredible warmth, of course, and love that I could give into the universe, and it would give back to me in bounty. And I think that is the power of gratitude.
I want to note, because we're getting close to asking you for your yes and story, that I have 5 pages of notes and I didn't get halfway through page 1. So that's a win. And you just mentioned love. And I want to say again in this recent blog piece, you write that people should, quote, use the word love in a meeting and mean it at least once a week. We're about to interview Marcus Buckingham next week, who has a new book called Love Plus Work, which is a manifesto about our need to bring love into the workplace, because if we don't love what we're doing, we're not going to do it well. This seems radical in business. It seems radical in healthcare. Should it be?
Yeah.
No.
I have to admit, in my younger sort of fully armored self, which had helped me survive some of my own circumstance, telling me that relationship-centered care mattered, or relationships mattered, or relationship-centered communication was a thing, mm-hmm. or I should talk about love, I would have laughed you off the stage. I mean, I just wasn't ready. And coping mechanisms I had worked so hard to build to survive my circumstance.
So how'd you get there?
Weren't ready to hear it.
What was the?
I think slow shedding of armor over time, mm-hmm. recognizing that I can't have meaningful relationships with my patients if I don't show up differently for them in their moments of suffering. I can't show up in my personal relationships. I'm still not very good at it. So I'm working at it all the time, just to trust and be vulnerable in those spaces. And yet the hunger for it sort of keeps me going on. When we trained clinicians in communication skills, I probably had my biggest aha moment, just that there was so many stories, so much suffering, no safe space for it to go for these humans that witness and bear moments with patients that none of us can imagine, stories of heartbreak and abuse and layers upon layers. And then we're saying, be healthy, eat corn, you know, you know, the emotional journey of people was heavier and complex and intimate. And when we attended to that, those stories and that suffering in our own employees and clinicians and people, it was as though you healed some space in them that allowed them to just heal and be the healer I think they were fully capable of being. And without a space to talk about it, it felt invisible for them. And in those moments, I would say that was probably the biggest chips in my armor. If they were willing to do it, I could too. If they were willing to be vulnerable in a safe space, that I could take that chance too. And so I do think that using our voices as experienced professionals, or just wherever you are, you have this great quote, play the scene you're in, not the one you want to be in, right? Mm-hmm. I stole that from you. And I didn't actually make that one up. Mm-hmm. That wherever you are, you can spread a little love. You can create a little joy. You can write a letter of gratitude. You can use your creativity and your voice to impact people around you. And I think that's the idea. No matter what meeting you're in, no matter what space you're in, you have the power to do that every single day. And what a gift.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can be the littlest thing. Completely. One of the things I have done in the last few years, especially with new people, who like recent employees, if I hear someone else say a nice thing about them, I will go up to them and go, someone was talking nice about you behind your back. And I swear, people are like they're just
dumb. They're all ready to.
And I go, no, just so you know, they're talking. I always like to tell people that because, you know, they might not say it to you, but they were just saying what a great human you are or whatever it is. And it's like, takes nothing. It takes nothing for me to do that. And it's true. I'm not making it up.
Yeah. We had one of the most beautiful, beautiful things. I don't know if you taught me or someone else did, but I'll give you all the credit. We had a very long-term patient on one of our units once. I mean, years, months, years, and very difficult situation all around for family and for caregivers for a variety of reasons. So we'll skip over that part. Nonetheless, on the day the patient was discharged, you could tell there was this range of emotions, but there was no activity to sort of harness it. And we asked, as the patient was wheeled away, you sense that. And we showed up on the floors. I went to the floors, gathered the whole team around in a circle, and simply did this appreciation exercise where one person just says, what I have appreciated about you is blank.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people, it was as though you lanced this boil of unheard emotion and energy that that just created room for peace and love and gratitude. And it was one of the most powerful things I've ever seen. And people were like, I didn't know you appreciated that about me. I was just doing my job, you know, and people were like, no, it meant more. It's just beautiful. So I do think there's something to the power of simply saying out loud, very specifically, what I appreciate about you is blank. What I love about you is blank. The way you showed
up. Make it specific. That's important.
It was incredibly powerful. So if you came up with that, thank you.
There is a improv exercise that we do that's rooted in that. So it might be. All right. I could talk to you forever. Do you have a yes and story for us to close out the pod?
I do. Well, I should disclose that I'm a full fan of yes and. I often use it as we're hoping to engage groups. And I had a aha moment. There was a decision once that a CEO made that I was in disagreement with.
Great. This is already starting well.
And I was venting in a very safe space with a friend that I trust. On and on and on and on and on. On and on about why this was, why my position, of course, was right. And the person sort of nodding their head, listening. They maybe may have pulled a couple of yes ands on me. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And then they said, you know, Adrian, I'm really curious. If you were to model the skills that you teach, what would that sound like? And I thought to myself, I don't want to be your friend anymore.
That's your first thought. There was a second thought. I know there was.
The second thought was, oh, that feels yucky. That is not the reaction I was looking for. And then, of course, my adult brain kicked in maybe 3 years later and said, so, well,
I was hoping it was going to be 3 minutes, but three years, sure. Well, what's time?
Of course, that's where I need to go. And it was so counterintuitive to everything I was feeling. I have to say, I want you to feel the amount of energy it took for me to show up in a conversation with the CEO and say, they said, well, I've made this decision. And I said, yes. And I want you to know, I can imagine why you think it's important to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how deeply committed you are to the organization.
It's all good.
And the values that we both are hardwired to. That's all I said.
Okay.
I did not bring a butt, and I'm hoping you can applaud or insert sound here because I still need to be validated about it.
Well,
but I worked very hard, and that's where I got. And it generated, he opened up in a beautiful way that was unexpected to say, yes, and let me tell you how I came to that decision and some of the things I considered. And so I just kept yes anding to pull more of him out so that I could show up differently to the conversation.
Well, this is where you've heard me talk about thank you because, right, which is more recent work that we've done. And that's that moment of it allows you to stay inside a difficult conversation. Not that you shouldn't share your truth, because you should share your truth at a certain point. But if you're not going to be heard, if you start with like just the cold resistance, no one is getting anywhere with that.
No. I do think it created more relationship credibility and longevity.
Yeah.
Because I was able to use yes and.
Well, that's a great yes and story. That's like ideal. You're ending the podcast perfectly.
Well, if only you could make it a whole bunch easier, I would do it.
Okay. We'll come up with more.
No, it's certainly a skill set. I think it goes that conscious incompetence, right? It's a skill set that you have to practice with intention, because everything, every fiber of your being, every neuron of your brain is firing in a different direction. And it takes intention and practice. And if you're hoping to bring gratitude and joy and relationship into the world, it's absolutely worth it.
That's a great place to stop. Dr. Adrienne Boisy, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. So good to see you.
The Getting to Yes And podcast is produced by The Second City and WGN Radio. We are supported at The Second City by Mike Farinaccio and Colleen Fahey. Our show is produced by Andrew Harris at WGN. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of the podcast is by Jukebox The Ghost. If you're interested in knowing more about The Second City, you can log on to secondcity.com or email us at works@secondcity.com.
World split into from the
survive.